Hi, I'm Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with David Edelstein, New York Magazine's movie critic.
Formerly of Slate.
Yes, and Blogging Heads has kindly paired us together to discuss some recent movies. So, David, do you want to take it away? What movie should we start with?
Well, I saw Jennifer's Body yesterday. I saw a lot of it, actually. I think you were at the same screening, although I'm not sure that I was paying attention to the audience as opposed to
Jennifer's
Megan
Body.
Fox Jennifer's Body. Actually, you know, it's kind of an embarrassment of riches, isn't it, when you cast Amanda Seyfried as the dog, you know, as the sort of the plain Jane nerdy one, and because she's really one of the most beautiful young women in movies.
Well, this is an ongoing problem with the teen movie where there has to be the plain girl and the beautiful girl, is that no plain girl, no truly plain girl will actually be cast in a Hollywood movie. So there's a huge suspension of disbelief as you sort of slowly learn to accept Amanda Seyfried. Did we decide to say her name that way?
Yeah, Seyfried. I think that's because it would be too depressing. I mean, let's face it, all of us, when we see people who actually look ordinary on screen, perhaps me at this very moment, get a little depressed because we look to see some idealized version of ourselves, what we really see. And I know this sounds like just rambling, but it sort of does have something to do with the plot of Jennifer's Body, right? It does ultimately get down to body image, as the title would suggest. We should say what it is. I went in thinking it was going to be a female vampire movie, and in fact, she's not a vampire. What is she? Can you say?
I don't know. I mean, she does some vampire-like things, right? I mean, Jennifer, the character Jennifer we're talking about here, played by Megan Fox. I mean, she certainly does some chomping on people's necks and so forth, but she's basically sort of an undead. I mean, I suppose you'd say she was a zombie, technically, right? She's someone who was killed and comes back in a sort of undead form.
Mm.
But even more gorgeous than before, which is important to the movie.
Yes, I don't know that I would. The problem with zombies are we tend to think of them in movies as sort of mindless creatures of appetite, and she is a creature of appetite, but she very much is the person that she was. She has all her own memories. She's more like a vampire in that regard, but in terms of what her appetite is, it's some unspecified. There's, I guess, a little bit of flesh, a lot of blood. At one point, you see her sort of drinking using somebody's open stomach as a sort of a bowl, a punch bowl of blood.
I like the fact that we don't know exactly what she is. It makes her scarier and more fascinating, right? You never know what's going to happen next.
It's true.
Sort of has an exorcist moment where she vomits up this sort of black bile, and then strangely in a never explained image there's these sort of pointy pokey things that appear in the black bile. It's really kind of horrifying.
Right, they're like needles, like little needles or something. All right, well let's go back. Okay. You liked it? Did you like it?
I did. To my surprise, I really liked it. Not unreservedly, and I want to get to the reservations. There are some parts of it that were really nails on a blackboard, in a familiar Diablo Cody nails on a blackboard way. But as a story, I thought it functioned really, really well.
See, I would have to agree with that. I loved it. And I wasn't, you know, one of Juno's biggest fans.
Disliked Juno way more than I did, I remember. Not that I'm, you know, an unreserved fan of Juno. It's sort of soured on me in the year or so since I've seen it. But
well, that's a very interesting thing, because Diablo Cody was, a year ago, a real darling, and most of the critics who saw Juno adored it. I think I was in the very small minority. But it's odd how she's become kind of a joke. Her very name has become a joke in the year that's passed. And,
well, she's someone who I think has some talent and some promise, but who may be harming her own career by being overexposed and sort of, you know, I don't know, I don't want to say whoring herself out, but, you know, just doing a lot of writing in a lot of places and appearing in our lives maybe more than we want to see her.
Well, in any case, she definitely, this is not a commercial project for her. I see a lot of personal themes in this movie. As much as I saw in Juno, actually, this is a movie very much about female self-possession, about how a woman is viewed by others. It's about, it has that same self-conscious, hyper-literate dialogue. Most of which, though, when you think about it in the context of gut bucket horror movies, works very well.
Well, she does something smart. Cody does something smart with the dialogue here, which is that, you know, that mania that she has for creating catchphrases and puns and kind of gimmicky, clever dialogue, she at least channels through certain characters who speak that way. It's not a universe
right.
that she creates in which everyone speaks that way. And Jennifer,
right.
for example, being the alpha female of this high school, it makes complete sense that she'd be talking in rhyming slang and, you know, addressing people as Vagisil and Monistat and all these sort of, like, you know.
That's, it makes Jennifer fabulously witty as well as sexy. And it also, and it's believable. And also Amanda Seyfried is so great that she really makes those lines sound like they're coming out of her head as well. And they, I think they have a wonderful rapport. What bothers me is that when Jennifer refers to a rock band as having a very salty lead singer, and you're absorbing this wonderful new turn of phrase, salty, and you're thinking about, sweat, excretions, you know, the taste of one's lover's sweat, the saltiness has to be repeated like five more times.
Exactly. That's
they have
the
to
thing.
Discuss the word saltiness.
That's the problem with Diablo Cody, and it happened in Juno all the time too. It's really something, you know, her loved ones and her editors need to tell her this. She always drives the nail into the coffin. It always has to be that extra. Remember in Juno when she's talking on the hamburger phone, right, which is a sort of funny prop, and of course she has to say, talking to you on the hamburger phone, right? It's just, it's got to be that extra twist.
Exactly. And it's a mark of insecurity that probably is very endearing among those who know her, but is less so in a screenwriter. But let's get back to the movie itself. In some ways, it's a very conventional teen horror movie in that one character becomes a monster. She acts as a sort of feminine avenger, right? She uses her body as a weapon. And what's interesting in the movie is that even before she has been demonized, she talks about her body as a weapon, as a source of power. By coming on to men, by using her, pointing her breasts at them, she is able to have more power than anybody else in the room.
That's right. She says something like, when you point these grenades at them, I don't know what weapon she compares them to, right?
Rifles or grenades, yeah, whatever, Gatling, who knows with Diablo Cody. I mean, well, so what did you make
of that, I'm sure.
What did you make of that? I mean, did you see, not to get all pointy head on blogging heads, but did you see the her demonization as a metaphor for her kind of enslavement to that view of her own body?
Wow, I mean, that's actually an extra twist even beyond what I would have put on it. I mean, to me, it was a pretty straightforward sort of female friendship narrative and sort of about the souring of a female friendship. But I really like the way that the movie stayed focused on their friendship. I mean, even though there's a lot of man-eating, there's still a lot of literal man-eating going on, I didn't feel that the movie was necessarily pitched at boys. I mean, obviously, it's going to bring a lot of boys into the theater because of Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried. But
definitely.
But it felt like a girls' night out movie to me. I really liked the way that their friendship, and I don't want to spoil the final confrontation between them, but I love the way that their friendship was paramount in that scene, and that the thing that finally brought Jennifer down. Well, again, I'm not going to give it away, but that it had to do with a token of their friendship.
Yes. Well, that's brilliant, and I absolutely accept your reading. Do you think that my reading is nuts? I mean, because the movie is called Jennifer's Body, because she talks about her body as a weapon before it literally becomes, she has the capacity to bite somebody's face off. Do you think that, and how, in fact, it's her own appetite that brings her down and her own use of that body? Because she is an addict, because she is dependent on feeding herself with more bodies, and she starts to go after increasingly likable people. It's not like she's an avenger in the movie. She's actually just feeding on anybody she can get to be attracted to her, which is, of course, everybody.
Right.
Because, you know, you remember that study they did.
I swing both ways, right? She says at one point.
She does. But you remember that study of men and women that was done a few years ago where an attractive woman asked, you know, stopped random people and asked whether or not they would immediately go, random men, and asked if they would immediately have sex with her. And more than 90% of them said, yeah, sure, absolutely.
I didn't know that study. That's incredible.
Yeah, whereas with women it was like, you know, 7% or 6% or something. People said, most of the people said, get away from me.
If they managed to round up Megan Fox, I wonder, it probably would have been in the 90% category for women, too.
For women, too?
And then maybe up to 100 for men.
Well, now, you know, there is that that rather remarkable kiss, what I think is so wonderful about it is that it's not porny at all. It seems unbelievably tender and sweet and sexy, and we can appreciate it on all sorts of levels. What did you make of it?
I expected the whole movie to be far more exploitive of the lesbian angle than it was, and that there would be a lot of sort of, you know, Girls Gone Wild style staging of sexy scenes between these two sexy girls, and that, you know, maybe some of it would be ironic,
too.
But you'd go to that movie too.
Yeah, I'd go to that movie, but.
But no, there was a real sweetness in the relationship between them. I love when they hold hands watching the band at the beginning too, before Megan has been demonized. I also feel that this is the first time I've seen Megan Fox that I've sort of gotten the point of Megan Fox, besides her sort of being a living Maxim cover girl. Because of course in the Transformers movies, she makes no sense. I mean, she looks exactly like that, she's styled like that, she looks like Jennifer, she's this sort of essence of sort of, you know, vampy sexual evil, and yet she plays this sweet girlfriend. It's completely senseless.
Well, no, I mean, she's sort of a joke in the Transformers movies. I mean, she's used, certainly in the second one, very, very knowingly as a ripe sexual object. But here, you actually see there's a pretty smart mind behind that. And it's also, she knows her body is ridiculously overripe. She's in on the joke in this movie. She's regarding her own body as an object. Her relationship with her own body from the beginning is that it is an object. It is an object of power. And because she uses it so wittily, because Diablo Cody has given her witty lines, because from what I understand, Megan Fox herself is eccentric in a very pleasing way. You know, some people say she's a nut. She seems to me to actually have a great mind. Beyond the great rack, and she is using that. She's using all of that to ingratiate herself with us, to say, I'm in on the joke. I know what you think of me.
Yeah, she gets what she's doing in this movie. It's true. And the movie is just much smarter than I imagined. I mean, I am going to say that I don't know if it bothered you as much as me, but the dialogue I felt lagged far behind the story. You know, it's sort of writing is several things at once. You've got character, you've got dialogue, you've got story, and I just feel like as a writer of dialogue, Diablo Cody has a way to go, or rather she has sort of a layer to remove, you know, before she can sort of find herself as a writer.
Well, there's a whole kind of sitcom element to it, which is that she characters many exchanges have to end with a joke. She hasn't learned yet how to lop off the joke to keep the exchange, but lop off the joke that they were building to. A teacher once told me that one way to understand Chekhov, for example, God, I'm bringing in Chekhov to a vampire movie, but with Megan Fox. But he said, you know, what's really interesting about Chekhov is that he originally wrote these stories that built to these funny lines, these funny twists. And then he just lopped off the twist at the end and kept the exchange leading up to it. And I always think when I see a writer like that, it could be even Neil Simon, you know, who has this sort of addiction to the punchline, that, God, you know, what happens if you remove the punchline? What happens if you just keep the exchange and you leave it kind of bleeding?
Right. Yeah, because otherwise you end up with this kind of ba-dum-bump quality, right, which is common to Neil Simon and to Diablo Cody and to many a shticky writer.
My own reviews, in fact, I would say.
Wait, you feel
from
like
that.
You have to go for the ba-dum-bump every time?
I have to build up to the final, you know, the sort of the joke at the end of every paragraph or the little button at the end of every paragraph. And I think, and it's funny that I'm saying this in regard to Megan Fox, but I think we should rip off more buttons. So Adam Brody.
That was your bit on bump right there.
Yeah, that was. Adam Brody is pretty delicious in this movie, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I didn't recognize him at first. He's fantastic as this sort of, I don't know, I guess you'd call him like an emo singer, this kind of raccoon-eyed singer who leads the band that they go to see at the beginning and who, well, we don't want to give it all away, but who sort of gets the whole evil schema going in the first place. He's fantastic. He's really great.
And whoever wrote
that song for them, the song that they sing is perfect. This sort of parody of a kind of, you know, a grandiose pop song that gets taken up by this town and sort of, you know, becomes the theme of the prom and so forth.
It's wonderful. And the great joke is the song itself will probably become a hit, you know, because the soundtrack will do really
well. Absolutely. I can see a fake video for the Low Shoulder, which is the band he sings for in the movie, going viral, can't you?
Oh, Low Shoulder as well. Look, this movie is so full of witty things. Here's what I don't understand, okay? I hate to spoil spoil it, but, you know, our dear friends, Charlie Taylor and Stephanie Zaharik, who both love Juno, Charlie said when he was walking out of the screening, boy, it's nice to see something good, because I just saw, when he saw me, like it was a joke, you know, like, hey, I'm seeing something good, because I just saw that. And I'm like, you think I'm good? You really didn't like it? And he didn't like a single thing about it. What? My feeling when I watched it was it gave me so much pleasure. And granted, I'm a sort of gut bucket schlock horror guy. But what is there not to like? What is it people, I mean, there was a rumor out before the movie came out that it was a real dog. What is this there about this movie that does not give pleasure?
Well, I'm very surprised. I'm very surprised that anyone who is a fan of Juno, as Charlie and Stephanie are, would come out with a bad impression of this. I can sort of see if you went with a huge animus toward Diablo Cody, which I thought you had, actually.
Huge!
Somehow be so defended against the movie that those cutesy moments, those nail in the coffin moments would just be too much. And you would,
it makes
you would
me want to go back
defended.
And see Juno again.
But if you like her in the first place, I mean, why would you not like this? Because you're right. It's just a wash in pleasure. I think it's going to be a big hit, actually, because I can see it being a date movie and a, you know, a girls night out kind of movie, and obviously a sort of fanboy movie.
That's right. It works on a lot of different levels, as you said, a female friendship movie, a really intense female friendship movie, a female friendship movie unto death and beyond death, as well as a great pinup, and something for men and women to talk about beyond Megan Fox's attributes. So good. Wow, we agree.
Yeah.
Well, shall we get to another sitcom-ish sort of movie that is, in fact, a documentary? It's called No Impact Man. It's on my mind because our mutual friend A.O. Fox just panned it and also mocked it and belittled it in a New York Times review. And in a way that, frankly, pissed me off, because I actually think it's a very valuable movie. It's about a guy who styles himself. No Impact Man is his name for himself, and it's also the name for the book that was published earlier this week from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. So it's a legitimate book. His name is Colin Bevan, and he decided that he was going to live an eco-responsible existence, that for 1 year he was going to have zero net impact on the earth, on natural resources, which means no riding in a car. He bikes around New York. For 6 months of it, no electricity. He uses cloth diapers. He uses no toilet paper, although they don't go into great detail about that. They get rid of their refrigerator, which does not turn out so well. They get a box of worms to do the composting, so the garbage even that they have will be eaten by living creatures.
They had running water, though. That was something that was never addressed in the movie.
They had
running water, right.
Oh, they didn't address a lot of stuff. They didn't. I mean, they cheat like mad. You know, they.
Well, apparently by blogging, right? He has to blog about the experience, so he manages to run a cord through his window.
He blogs though from the writer's room, also. Oh yes, he runs a cord from a neighbor's. So he cheats all over the place. But the movie works on two levels. First, I think it makes us think about our own impact on the earth and how much we take it for granted, the resources that we use. It's not an instruction manual, although if you get the book itself, there's plenty of links in the end to my friend Bill McKibben's 350.org and other really vital organizations that want to bring this problem to the center of our attention. But it also, as I think you've said, works, as you said to me, works as a sort of hilarious sitcom about this sort of Albert Brooks-like idealist jerk hero and the family on whom he inflicts his, you know, his vision, you know, who have to kind of go along while he leads them down this road to eco-responsibility.
Well, that's by far the strongest part of the movie to me. And I found some of the parts that just purely focused on Colin Bevan telling us how to save the world somewhat preachy. I also
He's preaching.
Colin Bevan himself.
Let's be fair. He's preaching.
Right. I mean, it's a didactic film, right? Explicitly didactic. But since it's pretty much preaching to the converted, and I would imagine that, as with An Inconvenient Truth, most people that go to see this movie already know a lot of this stuff and agree with him about it.
The converted need to be preached to. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to.
So you're comfortable with the agitprop side of this movie?
I am. I mean, I am. I've sat through movies that were all that. That's why I appreciated the fact that he was the butt of as many jokes as in fact, he was the butt of the whole movie's joke in a way.
I mean, I sort of wish in a way that that sort of reality TV side, I mean, good reality TV, but, you know, the side of it that had to do with, you know, two people in their domestic life with a small child being followed around by cameras for an entire year while they sort of stage this haggling over these details of this crazy agreement, which is, as you say, somewhat random, right? The rules are being made up as they go along. If there had been even more of that, I think there would have been a little bit more of a spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down.
The movie is not sufficiently self-conscious of, I mean, they don't make enough, I mean, there's a great joke in the middle of the movie when they turn off the lights at the six-month point, I guess it's New Year's Eve, they all get, he has friends over and they go, at midnight he's going to throw the switch on the circuit to all his electricity, but there's a Good Morning America crew there. Because he's been a guest on Good Morning America to document.
This movie, and
so you have this crew shooting the Good Morning America crew all in this little New York apartment, you know. And, you know, when you think about the energy that both crews are using and to document this thing, and yet, people who tell me that what Colin Bevan does has no impact are discounting the fact that he was on Good Morning America. This movie has been made, and if it throws the ball to us, if by becoming a celebrity and a junt, a joke, and, you know, Elizabeth Kolker in The New Yorker, did you read Elizabeth Kolker's takedown of Colin Bevan of the book?
Book?
I mean, she's a very, very good writer. I disagree with virtually everything she wrote, but she does have the grace to say that when Thoreau went to Walden Pond, that was a stunt, too. And he did that because he wanted to write a book. And
well, to hold this movie's stuntiness against it would be, its gimmickiness would be to just X out the entire movie. I mean, if anything, I just wish the movie had enjoyed its own stuntiness. Do you know what I'm saying? If it had sort of luxuriated in the gimmickiness. The way, I mean, I think this movie goes deeper than Murdering Spurlock did in Super Size Me, but I think he maybe did a better job of sort of, you know, selling the stuntiness of his stunt. Colin Bevan just takes himself so painfully seriously.
You're dead right. You're dead
There's
right.
There's a wonderful scene I love that I wish there had been much more of in the movie. I would have happily watched another half hour of scenes like this. Is when they were negotiating. Do you remember this great sort of quid pro quo scene where they're negotiating whether or not she can keep her refrigerator as opposed to having this like Nigerian pot in a pot system to keep their child's milk warm, basically two ceramic pots inside of each other, which of course doesn't work. The milk goes sour. And
how could anybody even have thought it would work? But anyway,
right? I mean, and that's sort of funny, also, right? The idealism of Colin Bevan saying this Nigerian pot in a pot is going to be great. So the milk curdles, and they
stand
and fight about it, and it's really quite a courageous scene in a way, because with cameras running, they proceed to negotiate whether or not they're going to have a second child. You know, based on sort of, you know, basically because she didn't get a refrigerator, can she at least get the second baby? And I felt like both of them were willing to sort of be so honest in that scene that, again, it's somewhat of a gimmick. I mean, being honest in front of movie cameras, is that really the way you want your marriage to go? But it made for really great cinema.
It did. And I wish, actually, that he had brought up the issue, because I mentioned my friend Bill McKibben before, but who was sort of a guru to Colin Bevan, I gather. I didn't know till I saw the movie and read the book. But he wrote a book called Maybe One, which is about how what's wrong with, you know, the myth of the unhealthfulness of an only child, about how actually if we all went out and had only, you know, just one, it wouldn't be such a bad thing. We would have live far more lightly on the earth than we do. And that could actually have become part of the theme of the movie too. Instead, he had this really irritating way of just going into himself and not wanting to deal with it, and not wanting to deal with her pain, not wanting to recognize her, not wanting to recognize her existence. So I understand why a lot of people, especially women who see this movie, would identify with her and just see him as a self-righteous jerk.
Yeah, I just scribbled down that title because I think I have an only child who's going to remain an only child, but I identified with her completely in that scene. And it was, I mean, whether or not you're fighting about something of the scale of whether or not to have a second child, just that moment of sort of producing, you know, a resentment and sort of asking for an advantage in return is just it's just such a wonderfully illustrative kind of scene from a marriage.
Dana, I wish I'd seen this movie with you, because I have a feeling that you would have been gasping and laughing at, you know, at different places, and it would have been fun to have. it would have been, it's the sort of movie, though, that I think the reason that I like it so much and that I hate the reviews like Tony's is that they don't really indicate, they mock him for such easy things.
Wait, summarize it again, because I haven't read Tony Scott's review yet. What's his problem with the movie? Just that it's preaching to the converted, as I was saying?
Well, it's a really bad thing for me to try to summarize Tony, because I'll oversimplify his argument. And I should say, it's a really brilliant piece of writing. Maybe that's why it got under my skin so much. But I also think he takes for granted the idea that we all know what this guy is doing. He sees its entertainment value as being Michelle, through the eyes of Michelle Conlon, the fact that Laura Gabbert was Michelle's friend, and whereas the book, No Impact Man, is written entirely in the first person, that we are allowed to see him in the movie through her eyes and see him as kind of a narcissistic jerk in a lot of places, and certainly a very insensitive husband. But he also thinks that practically, in terms of the argument of the film about trying to have less impact on the earth, he sees it as having quote unquote no practical value. And it seems to me that you probably agree, are closer to that in your opinion than I am. I think it has a lot of practical value. I think for one thing, just to live with the image in our heads of the no impact man, to see ourselves and our own domestic situations, be they urban, be they suburban, be they somewhere in the country. I think just having him as an archetype, for better, with all his flaws, has an enormous impact.
Yeah, I mean, if there was one behavior that the movie made me want to model, it was getting rid of your TV, which there's so many reasons to do, besides environmental ones. But I love the scenes of them playing charades. It sort of seemed like a great sort of unexpected plus of their year, that they became closer as a family in that way.
Exactly. And finally, I will say also, I know your wonderful husband had a biking accident and now always wears his helmet, and I was very annoyed seeing in the movie a couple of scenes in which he wasn't wearing his helmet. So did that bother you as much
as
it did me?
It's actually extraordinary. I mean, anytime I see someone wearing a helmet, I want to yell out at, cyclists in the street to put their helmet on. But it's rather surprised me that that would make it into the film, because he was so aware at every moment of his own image.
And the sort of
the virtue, the environmental virtue that he was displaying at every moment. So, yeah, that did strike me as odd.
In Manhattan, I was really pissed off with that. I said, oh, my God, I wonder what Dana's going to make of that when she sees that. I said, Robert, because head injuries from a bicycle are incredibly common in this city.
You need to make your own documentary about that, David.
You're riding around in traffic. Now I know you haven't seen my big movie of next week is Bright Star, the biopic, the John Keats, the story of his romance with a young woman named Fanny Braun.
I'm dying to see Bright Star, and I wish I'd seen it so we could talk about it now.
Well, I can't wait to hear what you think of it, because it's probably my favorite of all the literary biopic. Granted, a really bogus genre for the most part, but it's certainly my favorite movie I've seen about a writer that I can think of.
Can you think of another literary biopic? Any other that you admire?
I knew you were going to ask that, just as I said.
I'm trying to think of one. I'm wrapping my brains for one myself. I thought Iris was a pretty good movie.
Iris was great, but Iris wasn't about the writing. Iris was about her illness. Well, I guess this is about Keats's illness, too. I don't know. You know what? We shouldn't. You've caught me. I shouldn't go around throwing superlatives around like that. So
he thought of another literary biopic. It's sort of a biopic that's pretty good, which is Wilde, the Oscar Wilde movie. You like that, right?
I liked him. I liked what's his face. I didn't like
Stephen Fry as Oscar.
Stephen
Wilde.
Fry. I loved Stephen Fry.
Oh God, he's so perfectly cast in that role, isn't he? I mean, he was.
I didn't like
to play
the movie.
That role.
I didn't like the movie, but I loved him.
Oh, see, I do. I thought Jude Law was great in that role too.
Okay, well, it's definitely, it should be seen for the actors. I didn't like how it was constructed, but I think in this case, my vision of, I've seen a lot of BBC miniseries, of George Sand and all that sort of thing, and Chopin, and she was involved with Chopin, and there were all these, Impromptu, and there are other, there's this genre. The reason you probably have never heard of these things is because they disappear very quickly because they're terrible. But I always think of romantic poets as kind of lolling around under gray English skies, coughing in daintily into their their consumptive coughs and into their very exquisitely blood-dotted handkerchiefs and then penning whatever the muse has given them. In this movie,
there's none of that.
Well, it uses that, but it makes it so tactile and so painful and so excruciating, the lives these people live when they really feel that that's their job, to loll around and wait to be visited by the muse while they're hacking up the contents of their lungs. And the point of view of this young woman who's not a poet, but who desperately wants to learn about poetry and to share Keats's inner world.
Keats really did die very young, right? 26 or something like that?
I think it was 24 or
good
25.
God. So or it might have like been 18, 24. Kind of a Rambo kind of figure.
Definitely, definitely.
And I love those love letters. Keats's love letters to Fanny Brawn are just
well, they're the best. They're the core of the movie.
Is there
and,
a voiceover with the letters?
Some of them are actually read by the character. Yes, and the reason why, and it's unfair for me to talk about it when you haven't seen it, but the reason you can see that Jane Campion is invested in this is that in some ways she's redeeming the reputation of Fanny Brawn, who was these letters were published long after Keats died by her family when they saw that some money could be made after his reputation had skyrocketed in 20 or so years following his death. And I think that she was unfairly branded as a kind of Alma Mahler type, kind of a slattern, an attractive slattern who drove him mad, you know, who was so elusive that she drove this brilliant man to an early grave and then had the audacity to profit from his love letters.
That would take some serious feminine wiles to kill off a 24-year-old man.
I know.
Especially when
his whole family died of consumption, that TB, you know, his whole family died of TB. So, yes, you mean Megan Fox with the vampire who can transform?
Or just maybe by sheer wiles.
By sheer wiles?
Well,
Angelina
okay, so
Jolie.
Star
I think Angelina way. Jolie could possibly do it. I don't know. But next week opening is The Informant and the Daniel Ellsberg movie, both about two whistleblowers, and I know you haven't seen those. What have you seen that has really captured your imagination or really not captured your imagination in the last few weeks?
Well, I mean, I guess the thing that I've seen that probably most captured my imagination, well, one of my favorite movies this year so far is Ponyo, which I think has already left theaters in New York, so we probably shouldn't go on it about it at too much length. But
well, it tanked, didn't it? We can say that it probably tanked, and that in and of itself is an interesting thing. Why a movie so beautiful, so simple, so accessible would not, you know, catch on with a wide audience in this country?
I guess, I mean, I might question that it is accessible to the average audience. I mean, I think there's, you know, not a person alive who couldn't get something out of Ponyo, but has a Miyazaki movie ever cleaned up in the theaters? Don't they always have to wait for DVD to sort of make their impact?
No, I guess that's true.
It's a weird world, you know, it's a weird universe that he...
But this one very consciously tries to be more childlike, more it doesn't have all these different layers, sort of psychosexual layers that you got in Spirited Away or in Howl's Moving Castle, which even I thought was a pretty tough slog towards the end. But this movie is just a very, very simple fairy tale, reduced to, I think, very simple archetypes, also in a sort of no impact man kind of setting. It's interesting how much this idea has seeped into popular entertainment, by the way, that we are destroying our own world, that simply the human footprint on the world has become too large.
Well, it seems it's so much in the air right now, environmentalism and, you know, the question of turning the world green, that it's almost become sort of the new virtue in movies, is sort of this, you know, this figure for virtue itself.
Yeah, is that bad or good?
I think it's good. I mean, I really loved how the figure in Ponyo who most represents environmentalism, which is the father, is a very ambivalent character in the movie, right?
That's right.
I mean, right up until the very end, you sort of don't know if he's a good guy or a bad guy. It's almost sort of Colin Bevan logic taken to its extreme, because he's this extreme, rigid environmentalist, right?
Yeah, he wants to keep her down under the sea. He doesn't really appreciate what going up and becoming his daughter is a fish, and he doesn't, and he's half fish and half man, and he does not appreciate what in fact becoming a human, that actually she may thrive and find true love in the world of humans. He sees it as upsetting the natural order of things.
And sympathetic as the movie is with his view, and the sort of drama of the movie is about putting the world back in balance and, you know, and the environment. But in the end, the movie does affirm sort of the girl's discovery of herself over, you know, the father's environmentalism. It's not that he loses exactly. It's more that the message is something like, okay, Ponyo's father, you go do your thing, but, you know, your daughter has to become who she is, regardless of the world being in balance or not.
And he digs what she's become. He's quite happy, isn't he?
Yeah, but it is quite ambivalent up until the very end. Remember that moment that he's sort of trying to bring them down into the underworld, into the bubble?
Yeah.
And we don't know either. Neither the protagonist nor the audience knows whether he's sort of being lured to his death or whether he's going to, you know, have a happy ending.
That's correct. One of the reasons that I think that Nine bored me to tears is because I'm really tired of this idea that I appreciate the anti-technology movement, but I think the idea in sci-fi that sort of has no more room to grow is that somehow we give machines all these power over our lives, and then the machines take over and develop a sentient, you know, a soul, as it were, or develop a will of their own and take over and wipe out humanity. I don't really think that you need to show how technology can. I don't think you need to make the machines evil to show how technology can destroy the world. And it seems to me that, you know, now in the age of the Terminator and the Matrix and Nine, which I think you and I both found, you know, very striking but very dreary. Increasingly at the same time.
Yeah, it's so dreary that you cease to care about the fact that it's visually striking after about 10 minutes. But I'm glad that you mentioned Nine in relation to Ponyo because, Nine is sort of, to me, seems sort of like the negative effect of how great animation has become. You know, like animation has become so sort of so close to live-action filmmaking. You know, it really is starting to penetrate into the Oscar categories, and we're all taking it seriously. And, you know, WALL-E was many people's favorite movie of last year. And it's sort of the downside of that is that there's going to be a lot of bad animated movies coming out that look really cool, you know. And Nine really has no story. It has nothing to say. It doesn't go anywhere. And I found it sort of remarkable that after the 10 minutes in, just sort of saying, this is a really cool world, and I want to see what's going to happen with it, that I felt like I could be watching absolutely any generic action movie sort of on a Saturday afternoon on TV.
It was every generic action movie. It had the cliffhanger plot was as basic as you could come. And, you know, the more time that you're and I guess in what you said, though, raises so many interesting things because the problem with 3D animation is that it has to kind of go through the motions of observing the laws of the physical universe. Whereas Miyazaki in splendid 2D, I feel like I'm talking about, you really have to buy the mono new Beatles set. You know, you have to hear it in mono. It has so much more impact. The mono, the 2D animation.
Oh my God, David, can you imagine the equivalent would be that we would all have to put on glasses and experience the old Disney 2D movies in 3D now.
Right, exactly.
You haven't really seen Snow White till you've seen
it. Oh my God. You have to hear this. I went out, a movie that's vastly underappreciated is Looney Tunes Back in Action, that Joe Dante did, and it was Brendan Fraser, and it was, you know, humans interacting with the Warner Brothers characters. And at one point, they actually, it had a mad and very difficult scripting process and producing process. And at one point, they had a fabulous idea that at one point when Bugs and Daffy were shooting through space, one of the transformations would be they would turn into 3D versions of themselves, like a Bugs Bunny and a Daffy Duck, as if it were in a Shrek movie or something like that. And they actually did a rough version of it, and they all thought it was so nightmarishly horrifying that they didn't even want to. They said it would just give people who love Warner cartoons so many nightmares that they said no. And some people said, that would be funny. It would be so funny. No. It's too grisly. It's too grisly. And
don't look. It'd be like you're disemboweled or something.
Don't look. So the thing is that when you see the Miyazaki movie, the message of the movie is like in every frame. It's in the animation. Do you remember? I think I wrote about this in my review, but my favorite image in the movie is when Ponyo is running on top of these waves and during a typhoon, and the waves themselves, sometimes they're waves, but at certain points when they fall, you see that they're porpoises. and then there are waves or whales or some sea creature somewhere in between them. And sometimes they are, and actually the dividing line, there is no dividing line. It's like sometimes they are, and some you can't spot where the wave becomes the dolphin and the dolphin returns to the wave. And to me, that's the most beautiful encapsulation of Miyazaki's universe. The molecules are always in motion. Anything has any object has the potential to transform.
Just as Ponyo herself has these sort of three phases that she moves through,
exactly.
And she's very fungible about moving back and forth between the fish and the sort of fish with chicken legs in between.
Exactly,
and the
girl. She has so many different stages, and I think he's trying to tell you that reality has all these different stages as well, and that's in every frame of his animation. I mean, I think it teaches you to see the world in a different way.
It's a very profound thing to put in a children's movie as well, because for me, I mean, I was going to say that I know the running on the waves that turn into fish and back into waves scene very well, because my 3-year-old daughter reenacts it for me every single day.
She does.
And,
wow.
And I think that scene is really powerful.
With the waves,
because,
too? Well, you let her go in the water?
Yeah, she can walk on water. She's an amazing kid. Now, I sometimes have to enact the waves with eyes, which is a different character in Ponyo, the mean waves. But I think that that idea of, you know, something about this sort of dynamic being that is many things at once is just something that every child gets instinctively, you know, which is why even though in some ways this is, you know, a long and complicated and strange movie, that a 3-year-old sitting in the theater gets it instantly.
I agree. Go see it if you're watching this. Should you be watching it and gone this far?
Yeah, if you've
definitely
made it this far,
see Ponyo. I think it was given the back of a lot of critics' hands, not ours, but I think there are people who thought it was too childish, too simple. In fact, I felt that because the surface of the film was relatively simple, that it allowed you to appreciate his genius all the more. There wasn't a lot of narrative trickery to get in the way of just his pure vision, I don't want to reduce it by calling it pantheistic or anything like that, because I think he's unique. But I think that this movie just sort of, there's something about its simplicity that I found very deep and complex.
He does have a sort of spiritual, sort of sage-like quality as a filmmaker. I mean, he's quite old now, and I hope he, you know, continues to make movies throughout his life, both because I want to see the movies, but also because it seems that his vision is sort of, you know, purifying and sort of rendering itself down to something mm-hmm. very, very basic.
Well, at the same time, I think his early films are just as thrilling. But I do think that as he's gotten older, individual objects, individual things have become increasingly prominent in the frame. You know, the more contemplative side, the more, you can apprehend complexity in simpler and simpler things.
Well, there's a moment in that movie that where they're drinking the tea. Do you remember where the mother makes them a cup of honey tea? And it takes a long time. It's quite a long, quiet scene, something that you don't even see in a live-action feature film for adults, where three people just drink a cup of tea together and really enjoy it.
And I think the movie does, it's not one of these, it's not much as I love Mia's, Ozu, and, you know, it's not like you're being asked to meditate in order to be able to sort of change your biorhythms in order to be able to watch the movie without getting bored. You actually are lulled into this vision.
Well, that moment that I'm talking about is kind of a rest. It's like a musical rest, you know, a pause at the end of this phrase, and then all
Brilliant.
The action starts
yes.
up again, and it's just fabulous.
Perfect. You've nailed it.
Are we out of movies to talk about now?
I don't. Well, we've talked about 9, how terrible it is, and
There's
think probably.
There's nothing to say about 9. It's just boring and disappointing. And, I mean, good luck to the director. He's got a great eye, and I hope he does something good. But that was not it.
I don't understand. I just don't understand the people who. What do you? I didn't know what I would write about I probably wrote 3 lines about it because I didn't know what else to say. Well, what do you? I mean, I am kind of in awe of people who would find things to write about it that would be. You know, who appreciate it, who would find great things.
I just used the word burlap a lot. I kept trying to not say burlap so much, but
that's
what the movie was about, just bags of burlap.
I had burlap, and then I had muslin, and then I took out muslin, because I, and then I, then I just decided I would cut it short after two lines. But anyway, so I recommend everybody see the Dan Ellsberg documentary, and obviously Bright Star, and any other movies that are out right now that that you think they should see?
I don't know. I mean, we decided it was too late to talk about this because everyone's already talked about it, but I think everyone should see Inglourious Basterds, even if they're somewhat repulsed by it. I feel like it's a fabulously entertaining movie to see, and it's a big part of the cultural conversation. If you care anything about Quentin Tarantino or cinema, or for that matter, history, it's a great movie to see, although I had a lot more reservations and problems with it than you did.
Well, I had problems with it, but I also thought that I was getting a peek. I mean, Tarantino, first of all, in addition to, he's not just a movie nut, you know, he also writes amazing scenes. I mean, beat by beat, the scene in the pub, in the cellar of the pub.
Fantastic, absolutely
and
fantastic.
And the opening scene with the Nazi hunter, the Jew hunter, and the French farmer, just beat by beat by beat. Those are stunning scenes.
I agree, and those were the same two scenes that I cited. I think they're the same two scenes a lot of people cite as sort of like, you know, the cinematic high points of the movie. But sort of by inference then, there's a lot of things that could have fallen by the wayside, right? I feel like there's a lot of fat that could have been trimmed from that movie, and not just fat, sort of toxic fat. I mean, there's some stuff in there that I was pretty offended by, and I didn't get the impression that was the case for you.
No, because I think the movie is both a very awkward pastiche, and at the same time, all of a piece, because I think he's so talented, and he knows, and he thinks. We sometimes talk about how people think in images. Really great directors think in pictures. He thinks in old movies. He thinks in bits. This bit from this movie. This bit of music. This. I really think it has some organic connection when it appears on the screen. If Jungian collective movie unconscious that he's tapping into, genre, especially genre movies, you know, real grindhouse fare, but also World War II, also obviously spaghetti westerns. So I found it delicious on all sorts of levels. I'm interested though, what in particular you think is toxic, because that's a very strong word.
I would argue, I'd have to see the movie again. I've still only seen it once, and I really want to see it again. But I think almost all of the scenes with the bastards themselves, with the Jewish unit led by Brad Pitt, could be taken out of the movie without any loss. I mean, I think that the movie ultimately is about the spy plot, the espionage plot that Michael Fassbender and, you know, the German actress set up, Diane Kruger set up. And that everything with the bastards just felt to me like throwing in
and
a spider scene. Throwing in
and
a spider scene. And, well, of course, the convergence of the plots in the movie theater. None of which really need the bastards, except as sort of strong men that, you know, could have been dispensed with, I think.
Well, that's a fascinating idea. And I long to see Tarantino doing the non-bastards cut of Inglourious Basterds. I think that's when he's really more indulging in the sort of masturbatory wet dream of revenge that is, in fact, the movie's big commercial hook. But, you know, to be fair to him, Dana, that's not that much of the movie. You know, neither of the scenes that we've talked about that are the real genius scenes of the movie have the bastards. And I'm actually rather partial to the long exchange between Brad Pitt and the commandant kneeling on the ground, given the choice between revealing the whereabouts of his enemies or having his brains beaten in by a large Jew. I kind of enjoyed that scene. But that really is not the movie. That's far less representative of the movie than one would think from the title and from the image of Brad Pitt in the advertisements.
I mean, in terms of screen time, it's not. But the movie does end on the bastards, right? There's that long scene with B.J. Novak and Brad Pitt and the
negotiations. And it's very unsatisfying, the ending.
Yeah, because those haven't been that, for one thing, that threesome has never sort of converged before in the movie, right? So we don't really care about the dramatic resolution. And without spoiling, I can't give away some of the other things I really didn't like, but I didn't like the way some of the major characters met their ends. I sometimes feel like Tarantino just feels like you know, the way that every conversation has to end is somebody has to get killed, and whoever's there, it's, you know, it's going to happen. And there were three or four splattery deaths in this movie that were really narratively unsatisfying. They didn't fulfill any sort of revenge fantasy. They didn't advance the narrative in any way.
I think one thing that I do want to say is I was very, very unhappy with Shoshana's final scene. I don't know if that's what
that's
you're talking
about.
That's
one of them, about. Yeah, that's
one of them. But having said that, I do want to make the case for it because I found it unsatisfying too, and I still do.
Well, are we spoiling now? Should we give a spoiler
warning? No. I'm not going to spoil. A semi-spoil. Semi, maybe a little, just going bad, like one day away from you'd throw it out, but you could still cut off some parts and eat it. That's the level of spoiler.
okay, somebody could fast forward ahead if they don't want to get the
spoiler. Right. But we're set up to see her as delivering the coup de grace, as finishing off, you know, she is a young woman whose family was murdered by the Nazis. And we are setting up to see this as her revenge and as her being the ringmaster of this particular revenge. And Tarantino denies us that. And he denies us that in a very interesting way. He calls the final chapter in the film, Revenge of the Giant Face.
Right.
So in a way, so it's an extremely perverse thing to take her out of the movie before the revenge actually comes. But he keeps her image. And in fact, it is her image that presides over, that is that is in some way the thing that seems to be orchestrating the rather chaotic and to my mind, not entirely virtuosic final action sequence. And I think that, but metaphorically, he's saying that this whole movie is a piece of revenge. The movie itself is the revenge on the Nazis. We're giving Hitler bad skin. We're creating Jews who trap them in the forests and who torture them and kill them. We are just indulging in this. And I'm not going to have her go in and do this. I'm going to have the movie itself do it. The movie itself deliver the coup de grace. And I don't know. I think it's a great joke. I think it's a great joke. Does it work? Is it satisfying? Do you wish that Shoshana had stayed in the film? Yes, I do. But as an idea, as a metaphor, something about me really thinks that's very witty, and I wish he'd had the chops to pull off the big climax in which there's an interaction between the carnage off screen and the images that you're being bombarded with on screen. I don't think he's quite up to that as a filmmaker.
But he has so many chops. I mean, why would he lack that particular ability? Do you think action is a problem for him? Staging a big action scene?
Well, think about it. I mean,
one thing you can't fault Quentin Tarantino for is lack of virtuosity, right?
Well, no. I mean, in some ways, I think Kill Bill was his attempt to teach himself how to do action on screen. We've often thought of him as a very bloody director, but in fact, Reservoir Dogs is virtually all talk. Almost every single violent act in Jackie Brown is so quick you can't fully see it or happens off screen. I mean,
action, it's Sergio Leone style action, right? It's a
right.
showdown of some
it's
kind.
It's very stylized. But more and more I love Jackie Brown more even than his other movies because it's all those scenes. It's all foreplay leading up to the violence. And I think the guy does killer foreplay. You know, I mean, I think David Mamet should be in awe of, and Harold Pinter should be in awe of the way Tarantino builds his scenes. Because I frankly think he's in their league.
As a writer of dialogue, you're saying?
As a writer of dialogue. As somebody who understands the beat of a scene, the beats. In fact, he's a lot less repetitive than Mamet. You know, Mamet has created a language and has a somewhat limiting worldview that reinforces, that language reinforces. But I find Tarantino's dialogue much more elegant and much more witty and much more surprising.
It's really interesting to compare him to Mamet, the kind of ultimate minimalist, because Quentin Tarantino, I think I agree that he's a masterful dialogue writer, but he's definitely a maximalist, right? There's little curlicues and fantasies and, you know, digressions in the dialogue, completely different style, but it has that first scene of the movie is a great example. It's all digression, right? It's all talking about
I, you know what, I think I'm,
and,
I might have written that digression is his forte. That, you know, that in fact it's very witty that he draws out the digressions. He draws them out to the point that you realize that this is his pleasure. This is his pleasure. It's not leading up to, it's not the act itself. The violence when it comes is never as satisfying as all the curlicues, all the digressions, all the alleys we've gone leading up to that. And with that end very much in sight, you know, that's where we know we're ultimately going to be. But getting from A to B, before we get to B, that's where all the fun is, you know. Even with B in sight, that's where all the fun is. And some would say, I don't know that all would say that's a very, that's true of a lot of things in life.
You mean the foreplay is all? Do we leave it at that?
That foreplay is often much more satisfying and exciting than the deliverance. The deliverance will not often live up to it. Sometimes it does. It's never done so in a interestingly, it's never done so in a Tarantino movie. I don't know that you can look at any of his movies and you think, damn, now that's a payoff. He's always tricking you with his payoffs. They come faster than you expect and are done sooner than you expect, or they become weirdly emotionally wrenching, like the end of Kill Bill. The end of Kill Bill, you know, it's not like you go, yeah, right. It's actually this dying fall, literally. So,
I guess the question would be whether it sounds like you would say that he's doing that deliberately and masterfully. And I think I would maybe say that sometimes he seems like he's throwing in those, you know, almost in order to try to deserve the payoff, that he'll throw in the biggest, splatteriest, sort of, you know, most violent scene he can, as the tavern scene, you know, the way the tavern scene ends I'm forgetting the title of the movie we're talking about.
Inglourious Basterds. Yeah. Misspelled. But look, the tavern scene though is genius, and even if I couldn't tell in the end who was shooting who, there were so many cross currents already going on in the scene that I thought it was a great joke. I'm sorry that so few of those characters who I liked very much, especially the film critic, did not walk out of that they did not walk out of the scene alive. On the other hand, I'm so glad it's there. You know, it has that sort of what the. He wrote it over a period of 9 years, and I think in my review I compared it a little bit to Mulholland Drive, the great David Lynch movie, where you just don't know where particular scenes are coming from. You know, when they were written, how they were shoehorned in. It has this sort of dream logic. When we're talking about Lynch, we're talking about a very different kind of transcendental meditation-like dream than Tarantino, where it's all a little bit more on the surface. But I do think in the same way, they're both gifted enough artists that we can look at these movies that are all over the map and say that they are all of a piece, say that the stitches are there, that the pieces are joined, however crazy the final sculpture.
Well, can we hit pause and decide to watch Mulholland Drive and talk about it sometime on Vlogging Heads, because seriously, there is no movie I love to discuss more than Mulholland Drive.
Oh, Mulholland Drive can
keep
you up.
I probably spent 24 total hours of my life, at least an entire day, just conversing about that movie with people, and not because I'm an unreserved fan, actually. I think it's a work of genius, but I think it has huge, huge problems that I've never understood.
It makes no sense at all.
Explained to me. I don't just mean the story, but I even mean thematically, as a dream logic, as a sort of David Lynch dream. I don't know what the hell that movie is about or why it exists, but
I've never figured out the place of the scene where the cleaning person is killed and that whole scene that happens in the office.
Absolutely. All the proponents of the genius of Mulholland Drive don't like to talk about that scene, nor do they ever address the character that I refer to as Dumpster Dan, the guy who's behind the dumpster.
That's right. These were all figures who I think were going to loom larger in a television series. That in some ways this was a dry run at, so they were left in just because David Lynch probably, much in the manner of Tarantino, thought, gee, that's really cool, you know, it's too cool to give up. I see the connection in my head, even if I just have to trust that my audience will either go along with it, or you know, they won't even remember it.
Well, people really don't. I mean, everyone I know who swoons over that, the work of genius that is Mulholland Drive, it never talks about those scenes. They all talk about the same scenes, which are the ones I love too. But we will leave save that for a future conversation, because I would have to rewatch the movie to actually engage it.
All right, Dana, I expected this to be really fun, but I'm, again, in awe of your brilliance.
Oh, well,
and I really am quite honored to have been allowed to participate in this with you.
Likewise, it was a total pleasure, and I can't wait to see some more movies and do it again.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Take care, David.
Okay. So, hi. I haven't showered yet. This is what I look like. I haven't showered yet, and I haven't combed my hair, and I haven't done anything, but I'm here in my office. I'll straighten out some of the books behind me. That's my daughter, Lucy, because this is her computer, and she knows better than I know. I wish she were doing this. But anyway, this is the one-minute test recording that I'm going to upload for you. And I'll say my name, David Edelstein, New York Magazine. Actually, this is a better angle for me. It's great to be here on Blogging Heads, and I can't wait to have this conversation. So, that would be it. And Lucy, stop upstaging me. She will not be there for the actual conversation, alas for the viewers.